BCFM Radio.
The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be a benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A wave of terror attacks in Israel killed the 1995 Oslo peace agreement and brought Netanyahu to power, but who really planted the bombs? A wave of terror attacks in Israel killed the 1995 Oslo peace agreement. Dogfights over Syria between Russia and American jets this week. Who's going to shoot who down first? What are the Americans up to still in Syria, still bombing and killing civilians, despite ISIS being apparently wiped out and the other rebels being their allies? Just can't admit their regime change plan has hit a Russian brick wall, eh? And a radio play on tonight and tomorrow evening at All Hallows Hall here in Easton, Dr. Watson and the Communist Plot, where Lenin comes to London, plotting with Sherlock Holmes' brother, Mycroft. Well, you'll hear more later. And the US military developing Terminator genes to wipe out dangerous species of mosquitoes. But could the technology be used against us? And PressCoin, a new currency designed to pay for a resurgence in investigative journalism. Our sister show Dialects back here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. But you can be sure to catch it online. This week is a catch-up with the latest from the Portishead Railway Group and a Canadian professor who believes the war on terror is just an extension of the colonial adventurous tricks which were used to take over North America in the 16th and 17th centuries. Also, the author, the Reverend Stephen Sizer, gives his view on, far from being pious and God-fearing, why he believes Netanyahu's doing the opposite that the Bible's telling him to. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. Or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Let's start, Martin, with this dogfight over Syria between the Russians and the United States Air Force. A little bit concerning, or is this just the sort of thing that's been going on for the last few years?
Well, it's gotten it's escalated this week. The US are claiming that the Russian Air Force is not allowed on the I think it's the east bank of the Euphrates. But the Russians have never accepted that. And in actual fact, the Russians are flying air support for the SDF, which is the Kurdish-led coalition that the US has got their troops embedded with. The Russians are claiming that when they've been trying to attack ISIS, US planes have turned up and then they've had to avoid the US planes, and therefore ISIS have been allowed to escape. I mean, the Russians have been pretty clear from the get-go that fundamentally ISIS is a creature of the Gulf states and West, and that their pretense that they're fighting ISIS is essentially a pretense. And, ISIS have been allowed to retreat through SDF lines, which means that the Americans must have coordinated that. And as even the BBC pointed out this week, thousands of jihadis were allowed to exit from Raqqa with the full support of the Western powers. The Russians are pretty unconvinced that these things are unconnected.
Okay, Russian jets left the area soon after US jets fired flares at them. What are these flares? Well, they're not missiles, are they?
No, I'm not quite sure of the detail of what's happened, because obviously it's fairly confused. But obviously both sides...
Well, I'll tell you what's happened. The US jets intercepted Russian planes and fired flares at them.
Yeah, well, what I read was that Russian the planes that they were firing were close attack, close support aircraft, supporting ground forces, and then when a Russian fighter plane turned up, the Americans skedaddled. Both sides are on the trigger edge here. just any incident could turn into one or the other side shooting down the planes, and then it could just turn into a general free-for-all almost immediately. And that's the world we're living in now, total brinkmanship.
So also there's going to be apparently a delay on the banning of cluster bombs. The United States have decided that cluster bombs are going to be actually okay. Is that... I mean, is there any kind of enforcement?
I mean, they've been using them for years pretty indiscriminately, and they're now in Trumpian mode, just saying, well, everybody knows we use them indiscriminately, so why don't we just carry on?
So what are these?
They're dangerous because you've got lots and lots of small bomblets which are designed to, you know, spread around a large area, and then that makes a huge area of land subsequently useless to civilians. And of course, the main casualties are often children who pick these small bomblets up. And that's why there's been attempts to ban them.
We've also had this story from last week, which we didn't cover last week, which was that UK foreign aid money has been diverted to extremists in Syria. Really embarrassing. From the 4th of December, the government suspended a foreign aid project after BBC Panorama investigation found taxpayers' cash was being diverted to extremists in Syria. The only thing I found surprising about this was that journalists like Vanessa Bealey, who were doing the groundwork on this sort of investigation and who we've been reporting for years, literally... weren't given no credit for this story breaking.
Well, it's very strange. It's the BBC and other mainstream outlets have suddenly discovered that ISIS and other extremists in Syria got their hands on loads of high-tech weaponry and former Eastern Bloc weaponry supplied by the Western powers. But anybody who's been following the story seriously, looking at various media, is absolutely sure that that's what's been going on from the get-go. And it's being presented by the BBC as if this is an accident and they didn't intend this to happen, and that's why they've now closed down the whole programme. But in actual fact, of course, they've been deliberately supplying weaponry to these groups for years, not just in Syria, also in Libya, and before that in Afghanistan. And of course, the Russian general staff, the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff, they've got their own assessment of this, and they're pretty clear what they think is going on. And they're not fooled in the slightest. But of course, Western public opinion still imagines that ISIS is somehow our enemy, which of course it is, at least for public consumption. But in actual fact, most of these jihadi groups are being orchestrated by Saudi intelligence, Western intelligence agencies, and the Israelis have also allowed jihadi rebels to cross into Israeli-controlled territory in the Golan Heights and give them various sort of material and medical support. This has been going on for a very long time, and everybody needs to recognise that it's nothing new when stuff like this happens. I think what's very interesting about what's happened this week in Syria is that the Kurdish-led SDF faction has started to negotiate with the Syrians and the Russians about a deal which will allow them some kind of say in the future of Syria. And this is at the same time as they've got US Marines embedded with them, and they're basically switching sides, potentially. There are some problems with this from a Russian-Syrian point of view, because the Turks are very hostile to the SDF. But I think they are quite sensible in doing that, because ultimately, you know, they're going to have to negotiate with the Syrian government, so they might as well start now.
One of the things I've been looking at this week, Martin, is how do we get to the bottom of this, do proper investigative journalism, because it's taken 4 years or so for the BBC to catch up with what one independent journalist, who happened to be the daughter of a former Syrian ambassador, Vanessa Bealey, managed to do here. And I wonder what you make of the idea of starting a new cryptocurrency to fund investigative journalism.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about it to know whether it's a viable idea.
Okay, well, let's find out now from Nafiz Ahmed. And this is around about 20 minutes. I spoke to him yesterday about this. Now, Nafiz is an investigative journalist that's worked for a long time on things like, for example, he published the definitive book on the 7/7 London bombings many years ago. And he and some of his friends have decided that rather than begging from the big media empires to try and get a few pennies to put together that they will ask the general public to invest in their investigative journalism efforts. So here's Nafiz Ahmed.
I'm Nafiz Ahmed. I'm an investigative journalist. I have an academic background in complex systems and sciences. And my journalism, I've been led to look at all sorts of issues, ranging from looking into the deep state, foreign policy, national security, and all the way into looking at big environmental kind of write the stuff I really want to write, which doesn't really get commissioned elsewhere, is my own crowdfunded platform, InSearch, which I'm currently building into a kind of new next generation platform.
Can you say something about, as an investigative journalist, what it's like having to choose really between making a living at research that other people want you to do, other than actually being able to pursue lines of inquiry that you yourself find interesting?
So it's a real challenge, and it's something that I've always experienced it. And certainly I would say, as a young researcher who was moving from academia into journalism, and I made a decision at a certain point that I don't want to be in the ivory tower of academia anymore. I want to really find ways to speak to a larger audience.
Well, why not? This is surely a great platform, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about academia is if you're fortunate to get tenure or get a good position, you know, you can get a good salary, you know, stability. But the challenge of that is that when you're writing academic work, you're only really reaching like a tiny number of people. I mean, the average academic paper, they're read by like a tiny number of people. I think once that was like the average academic paper read by like 5 people, not less. So that's the kind of problem you're dealing with in academia, that are you really getting out to people? And for me, what I was seeing was that there was a lot of great stuff going on in academia, but it wasn't necessarily being communicated to a wider audience in a way that people could access it and kind of actually do something about it. And that kind of became like a bit of a passion for me. So, I mean, and one of the things I found was that, you know, I wanted to kind of write for a wider audience and do different things, and that's why I ended up making documentary films, things like that. But along the way, what I found and what many people are familiar with in this space is that it's very difficult to do that and get paid and have a salary or earn enough to keep going. It's very, very challenging. And it was only kind of in the last few years of doing this kind of work that I've actually managed to secure an income out of it and do it on a full-time basis. Otherwise, I was doing other things to actually kind of sustain myself. And one of the experiments that I was conducting at the right now with my current platform was the crowdfunding through this website called Patreon.com, which is basically like it's for mostly used by artists to try and get like regular subscriptions, or you can kind of get paid by a thing that you create. So I used that. I was one of the first journalists to actually use that platform, and I used that to kind of just do a call out to my followers and on various social networks and say, hey, look, this is how I'm going to fund my investigative journalism, which isn't getting commissioned anywhere else. That gave me the bandwidth, really, to do a lot of stories, even stories that I was publishing in more mainstream publications, like Vice, for example. When I was able to put in like a lot more investigative time and research into those stories because I had that bit of a cushion from the crowdfunding. Otherwise, as a freelancer, it's very, very difficult to do that kind of investigative work.
You talked there a bit about the next generation. What do you think that's going to be?
So what I'm doing right now is trying to build InSearch into like basically a global media platform for anyone who's fed up with the mainstream media and wants a serious alternative which they can actually participate in. So I've been working on that for the last year with an excellent team based all over the place. We've got people in the States, people in New Zealand, people in India even. And we basically came up with a simple idea, which was kind of just, I guess, an extension of what I was doing with InSearch, which was like, you know, kind of just basically a reader-funded investigative journalism platform. And our idea was, well, what about using the best technology that we can, like the innovations in the blockchain and cryptocurrency and things like that, to kind of make this a really powerful multimedia platform. So we combine that with looking at all sorts of different revenue possibilities, scoping out different experiments that we'd seen other people do in the media space, which seemed quite interesting. And we thought, well, why don't we make this thing completely reader funded, and actually give readers who are subscribing shares in the company, so they can participate and allow those shares. So those shares will actually give them ownership of the company, and also kind of give them a stake, an earnings stake in the company as well. So they can actually participate in the profits that are made by the company. So like a true kind of global media cooperative. So we came up with that idea, and we thought, well, the blockchain would be a really, I mean, the blockchain can be used in all sorts of ways, in some ways not necessarily for the best things. But we thought we could use the blockchain to do some really interesting things and create a different kind of currency to what's out there at the moment.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, look, people that say that these cryptocurrencies are used for money laundering, for example.
Well, yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is, I mean, I know people who use Bitcoin primarily to, because Bitcoin is outside of the existing kind of financial and banking infrastructure, right? So I know people who use Bitcoin to buy their weed. Because it's you know, that you're able to do it anonymously and all that stuff. So there's all that going on. But the interesting thing, I mean, and the other problem with currencies like Bitcoin is that they kind of extend the speculative and very dangerous dynamics that we've seen in the global financial system that we're seeing with the fiat world. And something like Bitcoin is again, I mean, there's a big question as to where is the value actually in this currency?
Well, hang on, because can you just explain what you mean by the fiat world?
By fiat world, sorry, I just mean the world of normal everyday currencies that we take for granted, like pounds and dollars and the stuff that national governments generally use to make, you know, to make stuff happen.
Yeah, but I've heard that word fiat a few times. What does it actually mean?
Well, it literally means, as far as I'm aware, the idea that you create money out of whatever, you know, you kind of just create the money. It's created by, it can be prepared, and it depends on the context, but either it has to be created by some kind of central authority, which is the regulating kind of body behind that money, and then obviously then the money is distributed and has to be recognised as such in the wider society. But it's interesting that obviously the word, I mean, you've heard of, I mean, people talk about something being created by fiat, the idea of being created by nothing. So there's all sorts of issues about fiat currencies, of course, which is related to the debt system and the way money is created. And of course, some people see cryptocurrencies as, I mean, like, for example, people like Max Kaiser would see cryptocurrencies as an alternative to that. But the problem is that they don't necessarily really offer, most of the cryptocurrencies at the moment don't necessarily offer like a viable alternative, which is different to the financial system as we have it today. I mean, so for example, Bitcoin is mined using these, what they call proof of work algorithms. So literally you have this computer which creates the coin by working through these complex algorithms to produce the coin. It's massively a kind of, manages a lot of energy in terms of its consumption. And the other problem, of course, is it creates this kind of monopoly situation where the people who own the most kind of mining power actually dominate the currency, which is what's happened now with Bitcoin.
Okay, so how are you going to do something which, or you're planning to do something, which is, how are you going to get around all this?
So what we're doing is, our currency, I mean, the great thing about the blockchain, the advantage of it, is that it's just a programming code. So you don't have to do what Bitcoin is doing, or whatever these currencies are. You can use it to create a different type of currency. So there are cryptocurrencies out there which aren't like Bitcoin, and which are done in completely different ways. And so our cryptocurrency is going to be pegged to real-world revenue streams. So we came up with the idea that rather than having a currency where the value is kind of like, well, where's the value come from? It comes from what, supply and demand, or hedge speculation, or the weird mining. We're like, no. Very simply, we want to have our currency backed by like a real asset, essentially. So what are the assets? The assets are the value of the technology and the revenue streams that that technology brings in. position is people are going to come on our platform, they'll subscribe. But as we grow our readership, because our token, our cryptocurrency called Presscoin, is tied to the value of our actual revenue streams, then the value of the token goes up in accordance with that increasing value. Nothing else. And that's what we think is a sustainable, realistic cryptocurrency, which is different to any fiat currency and any cryptocurrency out there, because no one's doing it like that. And it's something that you can say, okay, so if this platform is actually going to grow gradually over time, I can see that by investing in that, then I will have a there's a sustainable basis for me to earn profit on the basis of real kind of activity, real participation, real value, rather than something which is just kind of artificial.
Now, the Russians recently have started to regulate the whole area of cryptocurrencies. President Putin has said that the problem with a lot of this technology is that it's run by an unrestricted circle of anonymous entities.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's you're looking at basically things like Bitcoin and Ethereum and currencies like that, where exactly as I said, you've got these anonymous entities which are doing all of this mining, and essentially what's happening is it's gamed. What we're trying to do is use the blockchain to create a crypto infrastructure which doesn't play to those dynamics, which is truly participatory. You can't do that at the moment with Bitcoin. What you've got with Bitcoin at the moment is exactly that. People who are anonymous, controlling the mining power, and they kind of dominate supply and demand dynamics. And so you have only a tiny number of people who are able to kind of make profit out of Bitcoin investments. Of course, right now, Bitcoin is on this accelerating trajectory of you know, increased value, which everyone's really excited about. And maybe it might, I don't know how long it can go on for, it could go on for a while, but it's not ultimately sustainable because the value that it's kind of, I mean, where does the value come from? No idea. So our approach is basically, and that's what Putin is specifically referring to, is that whole arena. Now, and that's the thing, but the thing is you can build different things on the blockchain is exactly what we're trying to do, is to do something which is not going to be something that can be monopolized by a few, which is why if someone invests in our token, they become an actual shareholder in our company, which is completely different to anything out there.
But couldn't Rupert Murdoch invest in you and effectively take you over?
Well, they can't, because what we've done is we thought about this quite long and hard, and we wanted to balance out this issue of needing to make this as democratic as possible, but also safeguard exactly that possibility. Imagine some billionaires came in. I can't see it happening, but imagine they came in and were like, yeah, we're going to buy this thing out. These people are too scary. So what we did is we created a structure. So 60% of the company is basically the founders, which me and my team have control over that. And the 40% of the company has basically been given away in the share ownership. So what that means is that it allows us to execute on the vision that we have for this platform. Because if we imagine that exactly that, imagine it was the other way around, people like give away 60%, then exactly that, you could have a conceivable possibility of a conglomerate of people coming in, which has happened before. I mean, we've seen this happen with media in the UK. I think that there was an issue with the Telegraph and certain people trying to buy out shares in the Telegraph. But that was what we're worried about. So no one can do that. No one can come in and say, buy the whole thing, say, majority of the company, and then control what we do. So that was the balance. It was like, if we're going to do this, let's start off on a footing where the founders have 60% so we can execute our vision. And of course, to some extent, there's going to be, I mean, we're asking people to take that, to look at our track record, look at my track record as a journalist, and what I'm trying to do, and say, okay, yeah.
We've okay.
Got to execute that
also, your
and
vision.
We'll kind of explore how to take it forward.
Your vision. What sort of things are you investigating? Will you investigate? You know, if someone is thinking of investing now, what kind of things will they be funding?
So if they have a look at my platform on Medium, those intelligence that Google's out, they'll get a really good idea of the kind of stories that we've been breaking over the last few years. We've been investigating Anglo-American covert operations. We've been looking at dubious incestuous ties, for example, between rebels that have been financed by our allies, the Gulf States, and also by us covertly, and their links with Islamist terrorist groups. And you know, we actually did a lot of exclusive original reporting on that stuff that went viral and was picked up by some of the mainstream press. We've broken stories like how Google has been seed funded by the CIA and NSA. You know, like these are like world-shaking stories that no one is talking about. I mean, we actually did get a little bit of coverage for that story, but in really niche publications. So, for example, Gigaome, the tech news site, mentioned our story. So, you know, these stories are taken seriously, but other people aren't covering them, which is why you need like an independent platform like us to be doing that kind of work. And we're going to keep doing this stuff. Like right now, I'm working on a big investigation into Facebook, and some of the stuff that's come up is related to that famous company Cambridge Analytica, which has been caught out doing some interesting stuff in the run-up to the elections in the States and elsewhere. But we've been looking into that, and we've seen that actually there's a lot of stuff that the mainstream media just completely overlooked for whatever reason, which we're going to bring out. We're going to bring that story out pretty soon.
Don't you ever regret leaving The Guardian? Because it's a little bit easier, isn't it, to do your investigation and then just click, click, print it, it's in the newspaper all over the internet.
Well, you know, I have no regrets whatsoever about leaving The Guardian. First of all, I was terminated from The Guardian for stepping over boundaries. In that particular case, my remit at The Guardian was to write about geopolitics of the environment, and I had an environment blog called Earth Insight, and it was a great gig because I was able to publish straight to the site. They trained us up, gave us some supervision, and they said go for it, and it was a great gig, and I did a lot of good stories. And then I discovered that there are certain boundaries which you just can't cross. When I wrote about, I was writing about Iraq, I was writing about Syria, I was writing about Egypt, and thinking these things up. And then I wrote about how Israel's Operation Cast Lead in Gaza was potentially motivated by the desire to control Gaza's offshore gas resources. And I had quoted a policy paper by Moshe Alon, who was the defense minister at the time. And he created a policy paper some years earlier, basically saying how Israel needed to basically eliminate Hamas militarily from Gaza to prevent them from developing the gas resources, which was considered like an imminent threat. So I've contextualized it, brought it up. I didn't say it was the driving cause of the conflict, but brought it up in my article and said that, look, these are the kind of issues that we need to be looking at. It's not just about the immediate triggers. There are these broader issues going on. And I literally got a call the next day from my editor, and he just said, we're going to cancel your blog with you. And they did. They terminated it. They terminated my contract within hours. I got an email from the rights manager. So that experience, I mean, obviously at the time, I went through a dilemma. You know, do I want to get back into The Guardian? Do I want to do this? Want to do that?
Did they actually dispute the facts that you printed about this paper from Alon?
No, they didn't dispute it at all. They literally said to me, "This is not an environment story." That was their excuse. This is not a proper environment story. And I was like, I've been writing, this is exactly the reason you hired me. You commissioned me to write these stories that bridge the gap between geopolitics and big environmental energy issues. And that's what I've been doing for the past year and a half. And now I've done this in relation to Israel. You said, no, you can't do that. Which is, I actually went public about it at the time, and I wrote a piece called Palestine is Not an Environment Story. And they responded to that with an official statement saying the same thing. This is not an environment story, which is absolutely absurd, and people thought it was ridiculous on social media. media.
Okay, well, look, I wish you the very best with your new project. Just remind us what it's called and how people can have a look at it, find it.
So, I mean, the blockchain project is called PressCoin, and we've just launched the crowd sales, which called, or an ICO it's called, which is basically our big kind of crowdfunding thing, where it came, the crowdfund launched about a week ago, and it's going really well. We're really starting to get the word out now, and it's going to finish in the first week of January. So if you just Google PressCoin, Google InSearch, which is my publication, if you want to check out my work, please do come along, check it out, spread the word. Even if you're not able to kind of get involved and jump in and invest, and you can now, you can invest a small amount or a large amount, totally up to you. Do tell your friends, colleagues, kind of drum up support for what we hope is going to be a really powerful new media enterprise that will take out and take on a lot of the incumbent media that we have now.
And if you haven't got a lot of money to invest, you could always, I suppose, copy and paste and email it to a rich friend or relative.
Absolutely. But people are investing anything from like 25 quid to, you know, I had some of my own subscribers who were giving me like $2 in micropayments suddenly turned up and were like, I'm going to give £10,000. I was just like, whoa, that's amazing. So it's totally open. People can jump in whatever way they feel comfortable. But the great thing is, this is the first people-owned media enterprise, I believe, that is really trying to go big and take on what's out there. So yeah, do jump on board, do give us your support in any way you can.
Hang on, the BBC is owned by the people.
That's true, but they're also pretty compromised by standard conventional narrative. So if you're a little bit fed up with the BBC and you want to kind of make sure that the money is a little bit better well spent, we're going to try and do that.
That's Nafiz Ahmed there speaking to me yesterday. Now, Martin Summers, I think there's something quite fascinating about the idea of having something that effectively a kind of news type of currency as well as doing investigative journalism. But, you know, one of the things that I found almost the most fascinating of the lot of everything that Nafiz is saying there, other than if you set aside the fact that there's this fascinating new venture, quite brave and imaginative, is the way that he was kicked out of The Guardian is surely absolutely appalling. What he was writing was that the gas reserves off the coast of Israel and Gaza were told that this is not relevant to anything, any situation, and you shouldn't be talking about it, even though, of course, he's an environmental journalist.
Well, I think that The Guardian, prides itself on being the voice of liberal opinion in Britain, but I'm afraid it's very much compromised by its relations with the Israeli state, a bit like the BBC. There's an awful lot of soft Zionist influence in The Guardian. And, of course, on things like Russia and so on, they're just joining in the general stupidity which the liberal media in the US have got bought into.
Tell us a bit about Nafiz. He's written the first, the definitive book on the 7/7 London bombings, but he hasn't got any kind of national platform. None of the national media seem to take any interest. Why is that?
Well, he's too radical is fundamentally the problem. He was originally an academic before he became an investigative journalist, and his stuff is very, as he said, a lot of what he's doing is uncovering US, British, Israeli covert operations. And, of course, that's not very popular with those people who run those covert operations. And they, of course, have got their allies in mainstream media who are there to make sure he's shunted to the margin.
On a completely different tack, we have a play going on this weekend. Are you going to be going to see it, Martin? It's on tonight and tomorrow.
I'm not sure.
At All Hallows Hall. It's called Dr. Watson and the Communist Plot.
Is 1910. It is a new world, filled with hope and promise. Automobiles have begun to rule the streets, already pushing aside the faithful horse and carriage. The polluted air, as ever the product of London's divisive prosperity, also creates a certain amount of unity, Both the high and low born of London suffer equally as much from the stink. As I turned into Baker Street, I found myself worrying about my old friend Sherlock Holmes in this new century where none of us were getting any younger. Opening the door to number 221B, I am filled with memories of this place and a time when every knock at this door held the promise of adventure and excitement. Inside, I climb the staircase and stand again outside our rooms, holding my breath and, without knocking, I push open the door.
Well, that was Joe Hall reading his part from Dr. Watson, The Further Adventures of Dr. Watson and the Communist Plot, which is on at All Hallows Hall this evening and also tomorrow evening. So that's Friday the 15th and Saturday the 16th of December. Thanks, Joe, for that reading. Also, I'm joined by Mal Sainsbury, who's also in the play. First of all, what's the origin of this? Where did it come from? Where has it come from, this play?
Well, it's basically it's the first ever Labour Party Actors Cooperative we've got together. And politics is so boring, isn't it? So we wanted to make it fun as well. And we've discovered that there's a lot of politics in old stories.
So isn't it stretching a point to say Sherlock Holmes is some sort of communist?
He doesn't come across as... Well, we don't want to give too much away.
No, we don't want to give too much away. Right. Because he gets involved with Lenin. Lenin comes to London, and I'm afraid...
Well, Lenin definitely was a communist, wasn't he?
Yes, he definitely was. He was. But in the play, you'll find that there's some Cockney urchins that are going to be explaining Marxism to us. That's going to be fine. We're going to have... there's lots of questions in there about how does the plot get worse and worse, because this is a play with extraordinary and appalling special effects, which the audience will be part of, in fact, because it's the first time ever that a radio play is actually going to be webcast on the Saturday right through to all the other Labour parties and constituency Labour parties across the whole nation.
Okay, so if you can't make it, you can actually listen online. How do you find it online? That's the other thing.
That was what we were desperately looking for, actually.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll put a link up to it on our show page.
Fantastic.
But who wrote the play?
It was somebody called Laurie Barth and another person that co-wrote and edited with him called Paul Dawson. And they're both Labour Party people. And they've managed to rope in some amazing people to do this. Their director is Dave Lovett, who's quite a professional person. And somehow, from Sherlock Holmes to his awful brother
Mycroft
Holmes to the Cockney urchins to the
Hopkins the assassin.
Oh, the dreadful Welsh assassin, or dreadful. And then, of course, because time's gone on, as you just heard, the year is 1910, and in fact, you know, Dr. Watson has remarried, but he doesn't know that his second wife, who appears to be absent from home quite a bit, she's actually a really active suffragette.
Absolutely, and that's causing quite a lot of friction.
Okay, so those are bits and pieces you can tell us about. Is there anything else you can tell us? Because obviously we don't want to know too much about the plot. What do you think, Joe?
Well, it's it goes along at quite a lick. There's a lot of humour in there. There's a lot of pathos, and there's going to be excitement. There's gunshots. There's going to be all sorts of things are going to happen.
Do you think that these sorts of amateur drama, sorry to call you amateurs, but is it healthy here in Bristol? Because I know there used to be a theatre where a lot of amateur drama did happen on Colston Hill.
Well, I'm actually a professional actor, but I'm doing this for nothing. And there are other people who are just Labour Party members who obviously have a kind of a dramatic bent. So
I know there's something called the Avon Association of Drama, and there were the Rose Bowl Awards. Used to be for anyone in the city who was interested in having a go at acting. But as far as I know, there's very little actually on in the city centre anymore, although there used to be 1950s, 60s, 70s. 70s, 80s for quite a while. What are your thoughts about, anyone that feels like they want to have a go at acting?
Well, get involved, find out where your local amateur dramatic group is, or, there's a place called, I think it's the Kelvin Players up Gloucester. There's lots of things going on, and it's just a matter of you can Google it and, search and try and get involved.
Or your other favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Absolutely.
Also, Mal, what made you get involved in this? Why you find it such an exciting topic to do?
Because since I retired, I wanted to become a full-time granarchist, of course, because I now have time to do that. And because I'm a bit of a lefty myself, and I can't wait for the revolution, in fact. And as I said, you know, I'm always wanting it to take place next Saturday, if wet in Church Hall, of course. And now it really is going to be in the most amazing place. Bagatour Hall, which is All Hallows Hall, is a listed building. It's cavernous, it's echoey, it's got its own extraordinary atmosphere, exactly the right place to perform this piece of work. It's going to be very exciting. It is, in fact, full of adventure, comedy, satire, violence, romance, and lots of appalling special effects.
So it's called a radio play, but you're doing it live in front of an audience. I suppose, actually, that probably happens with radio plays quite a bit, does it?
That's right. Well, do you remember, you must have seen the Goon Show, you know, they used to, very similar to that. They're, all the actors are looking at one another and interacting with the audience and playing off them. So
we've got the Red Notes Choir are going to be doing some musical parts of it, and there's also some really interesting special effects, which I hope and I think are going to go slightly wrong. But anyway, the audience does have to get involved with this. So when we actually all, there is a point at which I believe Sherlock Holmes is going to track Lennon down, and it's going to be rats scurrying about our feet and the stench of the Thames, and it's going to get quite exciting.
And there's also an after party on the Saturday evening.
That's right.
Now, the after party after the performance, it's about an hour, so you arrive for 7:30 and 8 o'clock start. So the party will kick off from 9 o'clock onwards, and it's going to be a night of underground house music. There's going to be lights, fire, garden, bar and food. Dress to impress. Everyone is invited to get in their Edwardian glad rags, of course, for both performances. But I think because it's all in support of Feeding Bristol, and so that's a very good cause as well. That's why we're all so happy to give our energy and time and everything for nothing, because we want to be part of helping people at this time of year. And this is our festive Christmas show.
Fantastic. But what's the bottom line? How much is it going to cost?
Right, it's going to be £12 for waged people. It's £7 for low-waged people. And it's £4 for unwaged.
Fantastic. Well, the best of British luck to you. And can we just finish off with a little bit reading from, hopefully not any plot spoilers, but off you go.
Ah, there you are, John. And how is your Mr. Sherlock Holmes?
Alice, how can you know my movements?
Ah, John, whenever I see you in this pose, stiff-backed, whiskey in hand, looking down at your memories, then I say to myself, John has surely been to see his old comrade, Sherlock Holmes.
Alice, I have been thinking. I know these last few months have not been happy. If there is someone else in your life, somebody younger, perhaps, I would sooner know. I have no wish to be a burden.
Another man? Is that what you think? No, John, there is no mysterious man in my life.
Then I don't understand. Look at you now. Face flushed, clothes awry. How else to explain your constant absences? What am I supposed to believe when you are hardly ever at home?
Shall I tell you of my every movement, John? Perhaps you will soon wish there was another man.
And that's The Further Adventures of Dr. Watson and the Communist Plot. It's on this evening, 7:30 at All Hallows Hall, 13 All Hallows Road in Bristol. And it's on tomorrow night too, 7:30 with an after party afterwards. Mal Sainsbury and Joe Hall, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
As I was chatting to them last night, this sounds like it's been organised by some Momentum people, Martin, but the fundraising is for a Feed Bristol food charity.
Yes, well, it sounds like a spiffing tale, and I would encourage everyone who lives in the area or further afield to come along.
Okay, let's go back to some of the international stories this week. And I mentioned at the top of the hour the US military developing Terminator genes. I mean, this is getting pretty scary, isn't it? What they're saying is they're there to wipe out dangerous species of mosquitoes, but a lot of geneticists are saying, well, this technology could be transferred onto all sorts of other things. I mean, this is actually Terminator technology, isn't it? Which I think right from the word go was always going to be incredibly controversial.
Well, the US Air Force have been collecting DNA samples in Russia, and the RT and others have been questioning what they're playing at there. And it's certainly the case that over many years they've tried to develop genetically specific weaponry which will target particular ethnic groups and so on. And at one stage that was being done in South Africa. They were trying to come up with diseases which would only infect black people and so on.
This is under the Guardian headline. I mean, there's no real sort of comparison to that in the Guardian. But it says US military agency is investing $100 million in genetic extinction technologies.
Well, yeah, you could see that the way they're justifying that is, oh, well, you know, we've got problems with malaria, so we need to mess around with mosquitoes to get rid of the malaria because it affects our military effectiveness. But the fact of the matter is they're trying to weaponise all kinds of science.
This is DARPA.
Full spectrum dominance.
This is DARPA, which is the Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Yeah, well, an awful lot of public money is spent finding out how to kill people in more and more fiendish ways. It's not very...
They're some of the people who were behind developing the internet. We've also heard this week the Federal Communications Commission over in the US. This hasn't received much coverage as far as I've seen. I may have missed it, but this is an enormous decision to end net neutrality. It means that the big, powerful financial internet providers can basically swallow up bandwidth. And what they're saying is now this is an end to net neutrality that the Federal Communications Commission have ordered yesterday.
Well, also with the changing algos that the big companies are using, like Google and so on, they're basically trying to police the internet and close down voices that they don't want to hear, voices like ours, voices like Nafis Ahmed, etc. It's very worrying, but it's pretty predictable, given the fact that they're losing control of information flow. They want to try and regain it.
Well, the New York Times says the Federal Communications Commission repeals net neutrality rules. Federal Communications Commission voted on Thursday to dismantle rules regulating businesses that connect consumers to the internet, granting broadband companies the power to reshape Americans' online experience. They scrapped the so-called net neutrality regulations that prohibited broadband providers from blocking websites or charging for higher quality content. Now, this really means that, again, money is taking over the internet, and it may be that the idea of anybody like this show or me or you or anyone else having some equal presence on the internet with everybody else is over.
Well, that's what they would like to do, and it's because they've got monopoly power. And, of course, what should happen is they should either be broken up and prevented from having that monopoly power, or alternatively, they should be regulated, possibly run by the public sector. And ultimately, that's possibly what will happen.
And as I said at the top of the hour, we're going to have a look now at the rise to power of Israel's far-right Likud party under the stewardship of Benjamin Netanyahu, who seems to be now a permanent fixture on the scene. But a lot of this started, Martin, didn't it, in 1995 with the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords with Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat.
Yes, and of course, yeah, Rabin was assassinated supposedly by a lone gunman, but I think there's got to be some suspicions that that wasn't the case, because he was assassinated at a major meeting with full security in place.
Well, it was a massive peace rally. 100,000 people.
Indeed.
100,000 people gathered in Jerusalem to celebrate the signing of the final Oslo Accords, which actually gave complete sovereignty to most of the major Palestinian cities or towns, and then the Prime Minister was assassinated as a result. But let's have a listen now to this documentary. It's called PBS Frontline and Netanyahu, The Early Years, talking about the events of 1995.
Now, in Israel, Netanyahu was building a coalition of the ultra-religious right and security-minded conservatives. They strongly opposed the Oslo Agreement. And in no time, protests began.
The world celebrated that handshake, that historic handshake, on the White House lawn. But in Israel, there was a fair degree of skepticism.
Week after week, Netanyahu watched the protests build.
The people on the right in Israel were not happy about the Oslo process. And recognizing the PLO terrorists was a bitter pill.
We're demonstrating against the inability of the government to maintain order in this country and to protect the rights of Jews living in their own land.
With an election on the horizon, Netanyahu maneuvered the growing anger into a political force.
He did not believe in the possibility of a deal with the Palestinians. He didn't trust them. He didn't like them. He doesn't. and he doesn't want to have a deal with them. He didn't want to have a deal with them.
As head of the conservative Likud party, Netanyahu himself became the face of the opposition to Oslo.
Netanyahu saw a moment of betrayal and peril and an agreement that would never and could never work.
There's a really ugly character to it. The level of vitriol, the anger, the scope of these demonstrations, the kind of incitement, the portrayal of Rabin, the dressing Rabin in Nazi uniforms or putting a keffiyeh on him.
Netanyahu found himself at the center of the anger.
In most cases, he doesn't do anything about it. I think Netanyahu, even in some ways, benefits from this association with the rabble-rousers on the right.
Well, that's just before the assassination of Rabin, but this is obviously quite inflammatory, dressing the Prime Minister up in a Jewish state in a Nazi uniform, for example, Martin.
Well, Leah Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin's wife, at the time, Sharon was the Prime Minister, and he wanted to come to the funeral of her husband, and she refused to let him come. And that's probably because she suspected that the state, or elements within the state, had a hand in the assassination of Rabin. And I would probably concur with that. And then, of course, the Israelis tried to present themselves to the world as the only democracy in the Middle East, the sort of democracy where the peace-loving Prime Minister is assassinated, probably by his own security forces, and we all move on to a more confrontational stance. Pretty common in the United States, pretty common in Israel.
OK, and we have more next week. Final part of our three-part look at this, which we'll have a look at the election the year after, which brought Netanyahu to power. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Foder. Also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. I'll leave you with some music from 1983. That's Terry Hall and Fun Boy 3. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the grandfather of four children killed in a house fire in Salford says he's dreading having to break the news to their mother. Michelle Pearson's been in a coma since Monday when flames tore through their home. Her dad, Mike, says she doesn't know what's happened.
The first question out of her mouth is, where's my children? She's going to realise what's happened. How can I turn around and say, they've gone? All her young'uns, all her babies have gone. I'm dreading the day that comes.
Three people have appeared in court today charged with murder. Theresa May says today's a key milestone after the EU agreed to allow Brexit negotiations to proceed to their second phase. The Prime Minister now hopes trade discussions will start straight away, although Brussels say they won't begin until